Question the halacha, so we'll try to get started with that and see how far we can get. So the issue of de machsaro practically, we spent a little bit of time talking about yesterday, talking about the actual practicalities of individual circumstances. And a point I think I was talking about maybe with Avi afterwards, with somebody afterwards, that just more fully flesh out, we ran out of time yesterday, that what we seem to see from machsaro is that it has what basically seems to be three definitions. That on the one hand, the mitzvah of staka is specifically to that which is lacking, and the Gemara emphasizes that something that's not called a lack is not a part of de machzaro. So if we're talking about making someone rich, so that's not included because it's not lacking. You have to be lacking in order to qualify. So we saw that if somebody wants something or some kind of luxury that he never had before, so he's not entitled. He's entitled because he used to have it, and now he's lacking it, and then he qualifies. But somebody who never had this, who's not a Ben Tovim, who wasn't raised with a certain standard, is not entitled. Yet, the Mishnah talks about marrying off the Yosoma, so you're providing her with something she never had before. So that's not the only definition of Chisaron, something you used to have and lost. So what emerges is probably three definitions from our Gemara, or at least practicality. One is something that you were used to and no longer have. That was what many of the later examples in the Gemara was talking about. If somebody is legitimately accustomed to a certain standard and now has lost that standard, or something that is basic human needs. And therefore, it's not about whether you had it before or not, it's that it's a basic requirement of humanity or a basic need and desire of humanity. And therefore, that also qualifies as a chisaro. So food and clothes, marriage, lodging, all of that is going to qualify as de machsaro regardless of past history. And then there's a third aspect, which comes to define the second, that all of these issues, let's say clothing and housing and food, and also marriage to some extent, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, all of those are subject to varying standards. Right? The way people live in one town is not the way people live in another town. What qualifies as a house in one country is not what qualifies as a house in another country. So let's say you're providing somebody a house, and they never had a house before. You're providing them a wedding, they never had a wedding before. We'll talk about what that means in a few minutes. So maybe we should say, okay, so the fact that they have to have a lodging, they have to have some basic sustenance, so that's de machsaro no matter what. But then it should be minimal, right? If they don't have any past history, so then give them the most basic minimal food, lodging, clothing, etc. But that's presumably not true. Here we have another element of machsaro, that the society that they're in will set a standard. So whatever is considered a basic residence in this area, even if there are other parts of the world where you could get by with less, so that will presumably also enter into a definition of machsaro. You're also considered lacking something if everyone around you has it and you don't. Now, that could get a little bit murky. So how far do you want to go with that? And how far do you want to go if, let's say, you live in a society where everyone else has adopted a status that maybe is excessive or could be defined as excessive? How far does that become your responsibility? So major contemporary poskim talked about this. To give you two examples, there was a tshuva in the Tshuvas Minchas Yitzchak, it's in Chelek Ches and Siman Ayin Beis. It was written by Dayan Weiss, who's a rav as a dayan in Manchester before coming to Eretz Yisrael. And he discusses, let's say somebody asks you for tzedakah, and they need certain basic things. They need a residence, they need clothes, something like that. Or let's say they need wedding expenses, as is the context of our discussion yesterday. And they're getting married, they need to set up a residence now as a married couple. So do you have the right to say to them, okay, well, I'm going to give you de machzoro, but I think you should not get too fancy furniture. You should not get too fancy in apartments if I'm paying for you, so I want you to scale down. I want you to get it by less. Is that reasonable as a insistence for the donor to make? And in that context, so he notes that the Mishnah and Peyer, which I put on the list yesterday, you know, there is a certain threshold for what is considered poor and what is not considered poor. And discussing that as well, the Mishnah right before that, two Mishnahs before that, if you saw the Bar Tanuru, the point, the reason, if you were able to figure out why that was on the list, there the Bar Tanuru talks about somebody who splits his stock up in half, because he's going to give half of it to the aniyim of his city and the other half to his relatives. So let's say somebody wants to hold on to more money to give to his relatives, so out of his stock of money he has a desire to give a part of the stock of money or a greater part of the stock of money somewhere else. So he says, listen, I will pay for your apartment, but keep your apartment modest and keep your furniture modest and don't go all out. So as he discusses there, Revice, he thinks that this is a reasonable request to make, but he also acknowledges that he says you have to be aware that there are certain basics that people consider in each society a expectation, and that does go into the definition of what's legitimately machsoro. And he notes also that in order to live a religious life, so you often need to live in a certain neighborhood, as we know all too well, you need proximity to yeshivas and shuls and other religious people, and therefore that itself is going to impose certain expenses, and he thinks that that's legitimately within the realm of de machzoro. Somebody wrote an article in one of the journals, I think of the Kol Torah journal, which was an article written by Daniel Goldschmidt, if I remember his name correctly, and he was noting that sometimes you have a student who wants staka in order to be able to attend the yeshiva. And he wants to attend a more expensive yeshiva than the other yeshiva, but he's going to learn better in the more expensive yeshiva. So he knows, he thinks that that's also considered to be de machzoro, because that's also a part of your general well-being, and the assumption is that you only learn effectively in the place where you feel that's what's really going to work for you. You know, the Mlomed El Makum Shaliba Chabetz. So therefore, that's going to be included in De Machzoro also, at least to a degree. Rav Vosner, in the Tshuva, I think we mentioned yesterday, it's a Siman Reish based, in the Chelik Dalet of Tshuva Shevet Alevi, we mentioned his quotation of the Meiri, that the point of De Machzoro is that you shouldn't come to curse out your portion, so you shouldn't come to complain about your lot in life. So he has a whole tshuva there where he really emphasizes that people do have to get things under control, that you shouldn't go to extremes as far as what de machzoro is defined at. And he notes there, he stresses the Gemara's statement of lat l'hashiro, that your obligation is not to make people rich, and you have to worry about all the other aniyim in the world also. He says that's also a part of it. So you're not going to be able to take care of too many people if you're going to define de machzoro too expansively, whether we're talking about the donor or the recipient here, whoever it is who's putting too much of an emphasis on all the extras, so that's going to have a very negative effect on stuck in the world and in the world being sustained, and therefore he has, you know, kind of a muster shmooze there that one should be careful not letting this definition get too out of control. Hi.
I was going to ask regarding what you said about living in a certain locale that has standards of living, certain conventions of how people live.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the case, but today there's surely an understanding that people can easily move to a less expensive neighborhood or area or region relatively quickly, from an example like somewhere in New York to somewhere within New York City, from Manhattan to Manhattan even, that if you live in a very expensive area or say a gated community and you lose all your money, you lose your job or something like that happens, Dr. Shalom, would it be really expected for everyone else in this gated community to take on your very expensive mortgage and your very expensive cars and your children's tuition when you can simply move to like a very much more modest area relatively close by without so much trouble?
So that's a fair question as to whether all those terms are really accurate. You say very simply, easily move. I don't know if everyone would agree that it's so easy. I'm not saying the point is not well taken, that there may be an argument to be made that it's not the best use of the funds overall to focus on sustaining an individual in a setting in which it's too hard for them to live reasonably. However, you know, we do find, we talked about the Chovas Mechira, that the house is specifically excluded from the Chovas Mechira, there is an idea that where a person lives, and if a person is choosing to live in the first place and he's not able to afford it, so then we could say that, you know, Chachamein Barosho, and you should look for a place where you're going to have an easier time making it. But a person who already lives somewhere, so it seems to be that the halacha does see that as certainly a part of the de machzor, the idea that he shouldn't be forced to move and to leave his place where he is comfortable, a place where he has a certain sense of yishuv hadas. It does seem like not imposing that part is consistent with de machzor. Now, it doesn't mean there's nothing to be said, and your emphasis also that, you know, there are areas that are relatively nearby, you know, there might be a case to be made, and we're still talking about balancing various priorities, but I think part of that cheshbon is that the idea that the house is specifically excluded from the Chovas Mechira does kind of highlight the fact that that's considered to be a major part of one's personal identity. And to give that up is not considered to be a simple thing by itself. Not that it's never the right call, but I think we probably hesitate before calling that too simple or easy a first step. Hi.
You said basically you mean that somebody can't live without?
In terms of the things that the Mishnah, that the Gemara lists, you know, in terms of food and clothing.
So
and
like a modern day example, like a car. Like you could get by.
Right, so a car probably would not automatically be considered de machzaro. However, as Akiva was mentioning the other day, sometimes it's crucial to being able to make a parnasa, and therefore it ties into other things in a different way. And we also mentioned the other day a tshuva that somebody wrote about someone who at first didn't have a car, and then needed a car for work, and then lost his job, so now he doesn't need the car anymore, or have the car, but he became accustomed to the car, and became accustomed to it for legitimate reasons. He wasn't indulging, that was, at the time, that was his job, so he thought that would include de machzoro in the second sense. So de machzoro in the most basic sense, probably not. De machzoro in the sense of something he used to have, it could theoretically be in that level. So just, it's also important to emphasize, because we've been alluding to it also, when we talk about weddings, and that being marriage, being a part of de machzoro, providing a wedding, providing a marriage for someone else. So what exactly are we talking about? What do we mean when we talk about provide? We don't necessarily mean the shidduch, even though that's clearly a huge mitzvah in of itself, and a huge chesed, but that's not what we're talking about in Ksuvos and Daf Samach Zayin. So what are we talking about? We're talking about marrying somebody off. So we're talking about something financial. So what exactly do we mean? So I think you find essentially three different definitions, or three different stages, and they all have their place in halacha, and I think they can be ranked in the following way. One is anything which, if you don't have it, the marriage won't take place. Let's say if in a setting where a dowry is considered to be necessary in order for a marriage to happen, any type of expense which the lack of fulfilling this expense means the couple won't get married in the first place. So that's certainly probably the highest priority. So we talk about marrying somebody off in the financial sense. If there is a financial impediment to them getting married in the first place, so then that would seem to be the highest staka category that's associated with this. And we talk about hachnasas kala, everyone always asks, you know, we talked about the first semester about the sugya of hachnasas kala and about the ches of hachnasas kala, and we mentioned that it has a physical component in terms of simchas chasen and kala, and that's also associated with the tzedakah, so now we can bridge that over here. So what does the tzedakah of hachnasas kala mean? What does it mean practically? So first, most importantly, it means anything that will keep the wedding from happening for some kind of financial reason. So to take that financial reason away, that would be the primary. The second meaning, which is a lot about what we've been talking about today, and what the Menachas Yitzchak was addressing in his tshuva, is so married life has certain basic requirements, has certain basic financial requirements. So setting up a basic residence and things like that, which are a part of what it means to transition from single to married, so that would also be included in Hachnasas Kala as a tzedaka priority, and that's often what wedding gifts are geared towards, providing the elements for the couple to begin married life, having the basic elements that they need. So that would be the second definition of a tzedaka called Hachnasas Kala, I think the second priority. The third is the wedding itself. Okay, so we know that weddings can be insanely expensive. So theoretically, that's also something which one might want to raise suckle for. It's obviously a constantly controversial point because at the end of the day, it's the end of the day is over, it's a one-day thing. So how much do you want to spend on a one-day event vis-a-vis other stuckos? And is it possible to set a standard that encourage people to spend less? So short answer is yes, as a community, we definitely want to create a standard where people should feel like they don't have to sell their souls in order to make a one-day wedding. But the fact is that there's always going to be a certain minimum that to give proper chashivas to the event, which, as we saw from our learning the second parak in the first semester, that itself is also a basic part of giving the couple a sense of respect for what they're entering into, and has an impact on the marriage that comes afterwards. So there has to be some type of acknowledgement of what's happening. It can't just be, with all due respect to today's beautiful lunch, it can't just be pizza. So that's going to cost something. And that, within a reasonable standard, is also going to enter into Hachnasas Kala. And that should also be calibrated based on some idea of what is considered to be normal for the community around. You don't want the couple to feel any kind of bizarre, you don't want them to feel any kind of disrespect, to feel like they're in any way less than everybody else around them, or that their relationship is less important. But at the same time, so that's why it would also be very advisable for a society to try to do what it can to convey the message that it's not necessary to bankrupt yourself and all of your relatives for a wedding, and try to do what you can to convey that you can have a later time with less of a monetary expense. Amir?
So how does that work out with the Gemara that says, our Gemara, which says that the woman, if you have to provide for financially for a man, if a woman, the woman goes first because there's more busha for her.
If you're talking about the wedding itself,
right,
you're saying that it's asked for both of them.
Right.
Although there are preferences, you know, there are things that we do for the kalim, things that we do for the chassan, so even though the meal may be 50-50, so to speak, but there are aspects that are more kala-focused and more chassan-focused. But in terms of the third definition, you're right, you wouldn't necessarily find much room for a distinction between the two other than that, but it still could be within the category of hachnasas kala, that when you raise money, I think I mentioned last semester about my friend Kalman, who I knew many years ago, who was learning in the Mir Yeshiva at the time, and he used to daven a very long Shmon Esrei. And they had a policy there in the mirror that if you came late to shir, it's a good policy, if you came late to shir, they penalize you financially, they give you a knas, they charge you money. So he was always broke because he was paying the fines to come late to shir because he was davening a long Shmon Esrei. So he used to have to raise money from his friends to be able to come into shir to pay his fines. So he gave two names to this. One was Chinuch Atzmi, my own education, and the other was Hachnasas Kalman, that he was raising money that Kalman should be allowed to enter into the room. So that's not the usual definition of Hachnasas Kalman, but Hachnasas Kala. But you have a couple of possible definitions of what Hachnasas Kala includes. So among them is that it includes making the wedding happen in the first place, making the marriage happen in the first place, the basic elements of what married life entails, and the wedding itself. Well, within reason, all of these could fit into the definition of something that could legitimately be covered under Hachnasas Kala. And again, an individual might say, okay, but still, you know, how much do I want to pay for the shmorg when I have people who are starving elsewhere? So then you know, use a little synergy and get the shmorg leftovers to be transferred to everyone else. But it's also reasonable to try to evaluate exactly how much priority you're going to put one or the other when we're talking about different elements of Knesset's Kala. But at the very fundamentals, that level, really what our mission is talking about is it means that to make sure that they can get married in the first place and that there are financial impediments sometimes to even the wedding happening in the first place. And that's certainly well within the realm of tzedaka, and so much so that, as Shulchan Aruch says, might be among the highest priorities for tzedaka. Hi.
I don't know if it's still a thing nowadays. Do people still do dowries there specifically from the woman's side?
I think, believe it or not, actually, if you read about this, this is a big topic in Eretz Yisrael right now, because not dowries in the sense, I don't think they use that word exactly, but the idea that one side of the family or the other is expected to pay for certain expenses going in. and that the marriage is contingent on that, does have quite a presence even in certain aspects of contemporary religious Jewish society, and can become very contentious. And a lot of tshuvas have been written about disagreements about that and issues about that. And you can think of that what you will. It's a different kind of approach to life, but it definitely is one that has a presence today also. Morty?
Like engagement parties and boards category?
Somewhat, but you know, that also is a question, you know, how much do you want to spend on that, and why do you need both an engagement party and a board? You know, that's so in the Aguda they tried to make their heart was in the right place, right? The Aguda many years ago they tried to make takanos, and they tried to say, okay, here's exactly how much you can have and how many people you can invite, and I think they said one of the rules was the vort should be eliminated. Or the engagement, one of the two, I forgot the difference between one of the L'chaim, Vort, engagement party, Morgue Lounge. In my days, they don't do that anymore, right? In my days, it was Morgue Lounge, that was the place. It was the all kinds of wedding and hugging that they used to have here that they, I guess, abolished. They didn't even cost so much money, those men. But that was one of the takanas that they would have made, that one of these extra parties should be canceled. And they never take, you know, the takanas they never really take, because it's hard to argue with the people who want to. People who want to break the most often tend to be the most influential, right? So it's hard to really enforce. And there are sometimes a reason that there's always legitimate exceptions, and then, you know, what do you do when making a cross-the-board policy when you have legitimate exceptions? And so they tend not to really get off the ground so much. But ideally, there is an idea, just like we find by burial, that there was a takana, that people were killing themselves to be buried in a fancy way, that they were really going to great extremes to pay for funerals, until there was a takana made that she buried in Pasha Tafrichim, and that there shouldn't be any sense of competition, that no one should feel that they have to try to do what everyone else does. So there's been an effort to try to do that for weddings too. It hasn't really succeeded so far, but whoever wants to be the first one to jump in and to set the standard, there's no question that their star will be very great. And in all seriousness, that be able to show that it's possible to have a wonderful time without going over the top and without causing other people around you to feel like they have to struggle and meet that standard is a very important thing for society. Okay, was there a hand up before? Okay, so just to mention really one more point about this, I just noticed this morning in a sefer that came out relatively recently called the Shar of Ram, that he makes the following point. He says first that, so Dei Machzor that we were talking about as a communal obligation and not really as a personal obligation. So as we saw, really as a personal obligation, Dei Machzor seems unsustainable. Right? That you can't really do any one person's Dei Machzor. So we assume instead that it's an obligation on the community, and even then it's really hard to do Dei Machzor. So in general, it's hard to really have the full Dei Machzor standard ever really be a goal, and to have that influence too much your priorities in Staka. However, the Sefer points out, it says there is a way that you actually can fulfill Dei Machzor sometimes, and he thinks that maybe that should be prioritized. It says, because let's say you have a family, somebody like that, individual or family, that basically is getting by. You know, they have what they need to survive. But they have one sudden expense. You know, somebody needs surgery or something like that. Or somebody has a car broke down and they need a car. So they have, you know, one specific expense which they're not able to cover, but other than that, they're functioning. So that actually is an opportunity to really fulfill Dei Machzor. If you can pay for their surgery, if you can pay for their car, if you can get everyone together and cover this one-time issue, so then you will actually have an opportunity to really fulfill Dei Machzor in the complete sense as far as these people are concerned. And that's perhaps something to prioritize. That opportunity to really get Dei Machzor completely is something to consider. Come here.
Would we prefer one to, I guess, the money to allow them to, for us, I guess, people like Dei Machzor, and then be off, or I mean, is it better to give to them, or is it better to give to other aniyim that aren't getting by at all?
Right, so presumably it's better to give to those aniyim that aren't getting by at all, but just like we've been seeing on Sundays, that we have some competing cheshbonus, and we try to kind of proportionally assign it out. So one of the cheshbonus he wants to throw into the mix here is that if you have an opportunity to really completely fulfill Dei Machzor for somebody, so then maybe that's something that shouldn't be ignored. And the idea that you don't want other people to starve, but you know, this is a real need. Let's say a family has a sudden surgical need or something like that, and it's something that's not a luxury, it just happens to be that because they're otherwise functioning, so their machsara is more localized, and so an opportunity to actually address that for someone is not something to be sniffed at.
Would that be an obligation of the machsara if you had come across that?
Possibly, if you can actually do that. But then again, still the question is, how do you factor that into other things? You know, in general, there was the kashi that Achronim talked about, which we'll talk about it in terms of Hamavazves, in terms of that. So we'll hold off on that point and come back. Yosef?
How do you rank like a medical need versus financial need, like food?
Well, medical need, depending on what it is, but medical need can often be pretty central to life. Could be literally life and death, or it could be something that's so personally significant that it certainly ranks with the day machzara, because that clearly is a lack, right? For the most part, almost always the medical needs we're talking about are going to be somebody is lacking something that everyone else around them has, and in a physical sense, and needs the medical intervention in order to have that. So it certainly should enter into day machzara in the literal sense. The question of how to prioritize it against something else is always going to be a tricky judgment call. But it certainly deserves to get on the list. And he's throwing an extra factor here that not only do people's medical financial needs enter into the category of Dei Machzaro, but you could imagine a scenario where that could be someone's entire Dei Machzaro, and therefore you have a particular opportunity to actually go to the complete fulfillment in this sense. And he thought that should be a priority to keep in mind.
Could you fulfill Dei Machzaro through an organ donation? Like if someone's like a kidney?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. It involves a lot of other issues also. That's a worthy discussion in terms of what's involved in let's say living organ donations that you're referring to. It's a fascinating topic. Presumably, that's I think it would probably be defined more as chesed, but you're certainly accomplishing something tremendous. Maybe probably more it's either chesed or probably more in terms of hatzalas nefashos, which is attributed to other psukim. But no question that it's a gemara mitzvah. So that being the case, then goes on to say another point which I thought was interesting and also fits well with what we've been suggesting so far. He notes that the Chafetz Chaim in the Sefer Avos Chesed emphasizes that there's another mitzvah of tzedakah, which is not discussed on this daf so much, but is an important principle in terms of how you allocate your assistance money. And that is, the pasuk says, "V'hachazakta bo," that if you see that somebody is faltering, if you see that somebody right now he is in a position comparable to everyone else's position, he's making a living, he's functioning, but he hit a bump. So if he doesn't get some kind of coverage to take him from one day to the next, he's going to falter. He's going to lose his job. He's going to lose his house. He's going to become bankrupt. And he's going to transition from somebody who is not needy to somebody who is needy. So there's a particular mitzvah in the Torah of Achazak Tabo to stop someone from falling, so to speak, to stop someone from transitioning from not needy to needy. And he wants to suggest that presumably, building on the Chafetz Chaim, that that's a priority, thinks that's also probably very high on the priority list as well. That if you have somebody in the community, if you have people in the community who are needy, and somebody who's going to become needy because he doesn't get help that he needs right now, so the value of not just helping the needy people, but preventing this person from entering that category in the first place, is a particularly sharp and urgent form of tzedakah, which probably should be prioritized pretty high. And then he goes on to make the distinction, which is in line with what we've been saying, that he thinks that there's really a difference here between individuals and public funds. That individuals are more driven by Dei Machzaro because it defines their personal mitzvah fulfillment. It is something that he understands being a function of the giver, which was along the lines of what we had suggested so far. So therefore, the giver who's trying to fulfill a mitzvah, so a mitzvah, Dei Machzaro, is the perfect performance of the mitzvah of tzedakah. So because as an individual you want to do mitzvahs the best way possible, so then that's something which could rise to that level. And therefore, this point about, let's say, the family that has a surgical need or something like that, that might be a good opportunity for an individual to prioritize. He has now a chance to fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah in a really perfect fashion. But he assumes that that type of thinking is not relevant to the public kupa, to the public fund, and the public fund has to function more based on general objective standards of need. And in that sense, he thinks this priority that the Chafetz Chaim has of hechzakta bo, that that is something that is somewhat more objective, saying that this person is needier because he will be as needy as everyone else, but he will also undergo great humiliation in transitioning from one to the other, and you can save the whole thing by prioritizing this person. So he thinks that's a priority which is relevant even on the communal scale. Even the public kupa should worry more about that person than about those who are already needy in a continuing state. So again, that I think fits well with the distinctions that we've seen so far in terms of understanding how de machzoro and the mitzvah stuck on the personal level, the mitzvah stuck on the communal level, how exactly it all plays out. Hi.
Just curious, does somebody like Kadri Gezer and Tinek fall into that category?
Kadri Gezer and Tinek accomplishes, you know, has a good plug for them, yes. which they deserve. And speaking as a member of the Tinek community, but you know, Project Ezra has been a model for a lot of communities all around the world, that the idea of a communal institution that worries about the people who live there and about their ability to make a parnasa and their ability to continue making a parnasa. So you have a lot of the major points here, right? The issue of aniya yercha and the issue that the community should be directing their stock of attention to the people in the community. And especially not just in terms of donations to them, but in terms of keeping them employed, making them employed. So certainly that is well within the high ranks of tzedakah that we've seen so far. And this last point of very often the types of assistance they're going to provide, somebody who's on the verge of transitioning from one level to a lower level, and to keep that from happening is a huge fulfillment of that idea, without question. Okay, so yes, definitely donate to Project Ezra or to your local equivalent. All right, that being the case, so now, what about the sugyas of Hatzalah? So this is a major sugya, so what we'll do is we'll just kind of introduce it right now, and we'll probably, between our Chumash and our Sunday priorities, we'll probably finish it off on Monday, God willing. The din here of how do you prioritize between, let's say, men and women, a highly controversial topic, but one that is the topic of a lot of attention. So here on Daf Samach Zayin and Aleph, after the Mishnah tells us about this din of marrying off the Yosoma, so the Gemara tells us over here, three lines from the bottom, Yosotan Rabbanan Yosom V'Yosoma Shabol Hisparnes. So let's say you have a male orphan and a female orphan who come to ask to be supported, to support it. Mefarnesin es hayosoma v'acharkech mefarnesin es hayosom. So we sustain first the female before the male. Why? Mipnei shayish darko lachzor alapsachim v'ein isha darko lachzor. Because the male, he has the option of going door to door. He's going to be able to do that, while the female is not going to be able to do that. Yasom v'yasoma, shabo linase. Let's say each one comes to get married. Apparently they're not interested in marrying each other, although that would solve both problems. But they come to marry other people. So mesina se yasoma, v'yacharkach mesina se yasom. So then we marry off the yasoma, and after that marry off the yasom. Why? Mipnei shebushaso shel isha meruba mishal ish. Because the embarrassment of the woman is greater than that of the man. So, before getting into the apparent contradiction, but just to highlight here, what has the Gemara identified as factors and as elements in decision-making in this line? Right, basically two dinim, which both prioritize the female, but for different reasons, they're coming from different angles. Tamir?
Herbusha
comes up the second time, right? And what's the so maybe Busha might be about both of them, right? It might be the element that leads to both of them, but they still manifest themselves in different ways. So these are two considerations that really tell us two different factors in terms of how we're prioritizing people. Right? What are they?
Her pusha, her, I guess, one, I guess, coming to the wedding for the marriage of anybody, and the other one would be just in terms of going around asking for people. It's embarrassing to...
Correct, right, so saying, so two different types of embarrassment, but the point being that I think also drawing on these types of embarrassment, so the mission is cluing us into two different ways in which we might make a decision between two people. I think it's coming at actually two different points. Maybe Yosef, if you want to...
One's a psychological, the other one's a behavioral.
Okay, also a distinction, but it's also not exactly what I'm looking for, although all your points are very well taken, they're all relevant. But the point, the psychological need of busha in the second case, I guess that's what you're referring to. So that tells us that essentially the woman is needier, right? So we want to try to decide who comes first. So we look at the needier person, right? So since this single status and this inability to get married is a greater source of busha for a female, so then we're going to prioritize her. There's a lot of questions you could ask about this because, again, every marriage is going to involve one male and one female. So what exactly is the scenario here? You know, presumably there's some woman who's going to remain unmarried if we're not matching up everybody. So there's a lot you can do with dayak here in terms of, you know, shidduch making that should match the personalities, because, you know, somebody who's very technical would say, okay, so marry the osam to the osam to the osamla and tell them they're a perfect shidduch for each other, and that'll solve all our problems. So clearly we don't see it that way. We recognize that they may not be perfect for each other, and that even though the Yosam is looking to marry somebody, and she's probably embarrassed that she's not getting married, and he needs our help, but apparently that's not going to affect things the same way. But however we look at it, so here, leaving aside the complications that presumably every marriage is going to involve the two people, but the Soma, she goes through greater emotional pain, as you point out, right? So she goes through suffering, which makes her de machsoro more. But the first factor, is the first factor drawing on neediness, or is it drawing on something else? The sense of mitnei she'ish darko lachsor lapsachim, v'ein isha darko lachsor, is that talking about one is needier than the other?
Are you? Apparently it seems that it has to do with what's normal.
Okay, but what about what's normal? How is the normal factor impacting things?
Because it would be considered abnormal for a woman to go door to door, so there's a priority to not make them do something that's abnormal.
Okay, so it's actually, you're highlighting something interesting, which is actually, we should emphasize what exactly is the Gemara trying to tell us. But is the Gemara trying to tell us that she is going to, and maybe Tamir, I think you might have been getting at this also, maybe I wasn't realizing we were getting at, that is the Gemara trying to tell us that if we don't take care of this woman, so she is going to have to go door to door, and going door to door is going to be a busha for her, so we're trying to save her from that busha, in which case maybe it's more similar to the second factor, which is also about saving her from the busha that she's currently undergoing. Or maybe the Gemara means something else. And maybe the Gemara means that because it's a busha for her, she's not going to do it. Right? So she's going to starve. While the man's not going to starve, because if you don't pay attention to him, he's going to knock door to door. So then it's not so much about saving her from the busha. It's about if they have two people, and one has other options and one doesn't, so maybe we should prioritize the one who has no other options. So since the man has the option of knocking door to door, and for the woman it's too scandalous, so she is now ultimately, even though right now they're both just as hungry, but one has other options and one doesn't, so then that becomes a reason to prioritize. Marty?
I think the way I interpreted it, and I think same thing with Tamir, meaning you wouldn't expect a woman if she's literally starving to death. That she, I mean, it might be dark, sort of like, at a certain point, like she would resort to that.
Maybe she wouldn't, but maybe it would end up being much less effective. Maybe no one will pay attention to it. Right? Let's say you have a community where it's considered totally scandalous for a woman to knock on people's doors. So it's certainly possible that she's going to go to bed hungry rather than do that. But it's also possible that no one's going to open the door for her. It's also possible that no one's going to pay attention. So it could mean that even if she gets desperate, it's still going to be a long time before she gets the same type of sustenance that the man could get under those circumstances. So this is going to be relevant to trying to understand the apparent stira between this and a very famous Mishnah in the Maseches Horias. And we'll just basically mention the stira and lay it out a little bit, and we'll have to fill in more about it next time. So, the Shulchan Aruch paskins. Shulchan Aruch is in the Siman Reish Ben Aleph. Paskins like this din, and says that the woman gets highest priority in terms of staka, whether it's food, clothing, or a wedding. Any of these needs, essentially, he sees this all as one package, because our Gemara doesn't really distinguish between the causes, gives different reasons, but ultimately keeps saying the Yisoma comes first. So therefore, that's essentially what the Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin, that whether it's clothing, whether it's food, whether it's marriage, so the woman gets the highest priority. So the commentary is on the side of the Torah, and the side of the Shulchan Aruch, where you have this psak. So they ask from the Mishnah and Harias. What does the Mishnah and Harias say? What's the din of the Mishnah and Harias? A very controversial Mishnah that's always talked about in a lot of contemporary issues. That's Tamir.
It says in terms of l'hachayos, mm-hmm. whatever that means.
Right. Emphasis on whatever that means. Right.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly what that means.
Yeah,
but
so
to livify,
right.
to enliven.
So mm-hmm. the man takes precedence over the woman?
Yes.
Whereas,
so for some purpose, which is not 100% defined, but involves life, so the man comes first, and also Hashem v'Saveda, the Mishnah lists, and the man comes first, and then the Mishnah also goes on to give a bunch of other categories, Kohen, Levi, Talmud Chacham, etc., etc. So, how do you reconcile those two? Right, how do you, on the one hand, look at our Gemara, which says that we feed the woman first, and the Mishnah in Harias that says we sustain and livinate the male first. So how do you reconcile those two? And who talks about this? Rishonim talk about this, Achronim talk about this. What are some of the suggestions that we find? How do you address that chiluk? Anyone want to recommend any? Right on the daf, if you want to look, if you just have the Gemara in front of you, and you have the Gemara that has the Tosfos Rid on the daf, so that's one Rishon on the daf who actually addresses it. But other than that, the Beis Yosef and the Shach and a few other places is talking about, so what are the Meiri talks about this, so what are some of the approaches that you find? Are you?
Beis Yosef suggests that there's a difference between saving a life, like someone drowning,
mm-hmm.
two people drowning in a river, and feeding
right. Okay, so first of all, so the Beis Yosef has to account for the Torah's position and his own position in Shulchan Aruch, that he assumes that for all tzedakah purposes, women come first. As opposed to some of the Rishonim, who translate a little bit differently, right? Like the Rashba and the Chiddush Haran, if you saw that, that they assume against the Shulchan Aruch, that our Gemara must be talking actually about clothing, which is a little bit harder to read into the words, but that's what we're talking about here, which is not about basic lubrification. But l'hachayos, that's a reference to food. So in terms of food, so taka, that's what Horius is talking about, the man's going to come first. But in terms of clothes, where there's going to be also a greater sense of busha, a woman who doesn't have clothing, it's going to be much more problematic for her than a man who doesn't have clothing. And it's also going to tie in a little bit to her ability or lack of ability to go from door to door. So therefore that becomes a higher priority for the woman, while the food, taka, that's what Harius is talking about, that's talking about sustenance. That's how some of the Rishonim over here say. However, the Beis Yosef, in explaining his own view, and the Torah's view says, like Aryeh says, that we're talking about two different things. That on Ardaf, we're talking about staka priorities, and in the Mishnah and Harias, we're talking about Tatzalas Nefashos. So essentially there, we're talking about if you have to save somebody's life, whose life do you save first? Highly controversial point. So there, for whatever reason, we'll have to try to talk about what it is and how practical it is, but for whatever reason, so the Mishnah says you'll save the man's life first. And that, by the way, is brought in the Ramah, in the next Siman, in Reish Min Beis. The Ramah talks about Hatzalah and brings that in. But the Shulchan Aruch here, when he makes his priority, he's talking about not saving somebody's life, he's talking about giving tzedakah, and how do you prioritize who you give tzedakah to for whatever purpose, that's the din in Ksubis that you prioritize the woman. What other approaches do you find? One that draws heavily on this point of Dark Walachsu al Psachim. Right? So what the Meiri and others note, we'll have to get into this a little bit more, that here our Gemara is assuming that there are other options. Right? There's a possibility of being a Chozer al Psachim, that if you're not going to give Staka, well, eventually they'll get Staka from someone else. So it's just a question of, are we saving them from being Chozer al Psachim? Right, which goes back to Morty's point and maybe Tamir's point that maybe the issue is that ultimately someone is going to be Machzer al Psachim, and our Gemara is just talking about saving them from doing that. While Horius, there's no Psachim to be Machzer on. In Horius, you're on a boat, and you're going to drown. So it's all about, will you save this person's life or will no one save this person's life? And then, for whatever reason, the Mishnah has the Kedima that it has. Now, how exactly do we understand that, and how have contemporary poskim addressed this? There's a major tshuva about this in the tshuvas Tzitz Eliezer, Shlomo Zalman, Moshe Feinstein, all the major poskim have tshuvas about this highly sensitive and controversial idea. So we'll, Bez Hashem, we'll have to fill some of those points in next time. A question?
According to the Beis Yosef, if you have two people, if you have a man and a woman in front of you, and they're about, they could die at that moment, then you have to give them tzedakah, you have to give them food, would you say that the men would go?
Because it'll turn into...
Because that would be l'hachayos, but it would also be tzedakah, so...
Right, so it then turn into hatzala, right. You know, it probably would turn into hatzala, although that would also involve its own complications, so let's leave that for part two. Okay, so let's just quickly recap what we saw so far, and then we're all about Mincha. So first we had a shir lunch, and we met the following people. And alright, so we'll skip that part, but as far as the shir slot, so we talked about other practical applications of Dei Machzoro. We talked about the Tshuvas in the Minchas Yitzchak and the Shevet Halevi, about how much do you have to go into lavish needs of people. Talked about the three different definitions of machzoro, that which is accustomed from the past and you no longer have, that which is a basic human need, and defining that basic human need based on what is the cultural standard in the place that you are in. We talked about the different definitions of what marrying somebody off financially means, and we ranked them on a priority list in three different ways. First is anything that's necessary to make sure the wedding actually happens. Second are the basic needs of married life in the early stages. And third is the wedding itself, which is subject to varying degrees and varying social standards. And then we talked about the Shah of Ram, who made the point that De Machzoro, even though it's generally assumed to be out of the reach of any one individual, theoretically it could be in the reach, that if you have a family that's basically making it, but they have one localized need, so then that's an opportunity to really do Dei Machzoro, and maybe that should be prioritized. And then he goes on to say that kind of cheshbon really is only relevant to private money, because that's a part of the key in mitzvah tzedakah in the most perfect way, so the individual who's choosing to focus on the mitzvah that he's doing will do it in the most perfect way in such a context. While public funds don't have that kind of cheshbon, we thought public funds are more affected by a point the Chafetz Chaim makes, that there is a mitzvah of hechazakta bo. It's a more urgent form of tzedakah, essentially, that if somebody is about to transition from not being needy to being needy, so to save them from that transition is also certainly a key of tzedakah, and a greater priority even than someone who's already needy. And that, by the way, also is where one of the other major mitzvahs of chesed comes in. There's a mitzvah of chesed to lend money. So that's particularly relevant to somebody in that position. Usually somebody in that position can be kept afloat with a loan, which they can pay back later, which is also something our Gemara alludes to. And the mitzvah of loaning money is one of the major mitzvahs in the Torah, which is what's emphasized, just parenthetically, by this year. Right. So the fact that we have a concept of prizbul, which is always also a controversial topic of discussion about how mitzvah in the Torah is affected by rabbinic innovation. In this case, we assume really that Shemitah nowadays is Drabbanan, really, as the Gemara points out. But the fact that the Torah tells us to cancel loans, and yet we have this mechanism by which we don't have to cancel loans. That's because we're afraid that this crucial mitzvah is going to get neglected, that we have an obligation to lend money to people who are in need, and we're afraid that somebody will say, like the Torah itself expresses exactly this concern, and the Torah says very harsh words, somebody, Belial, somebody who doesn't believe in God, essentially, somebody who doesn't have any kind of sense of the yoke of heaven, will say, okay, Karva Shnasa Sheva, it's almost time for Shemitah year, if I lend money now, it's going to get canceled right away, so I'm not going to do it. So Chas V'Shalom, anyone should have such a thought, anyone should hold back from lending money to somebody in need because of that. So the principle is there to address that. So that's all a part of Hatzak Tavo. And as he goes on to say, that this is something which maybe takes a priority even at a communal level, because it goes to the nature of the need, and therefore is more objective. And then we talked about these priorities that the Gemara tells us about the Yosoma coming before Yosom, both for getting married because her busha is greater, and for Parnasa because Ein Dark Alachzer L'Psachim. So we talked a little bit about whether that's identifying two different factors, the greater need that comes from the busha and the lack of other options that comes from not wanting to be Chozer L'Psachim, or as many were suggesting, maybe the assumption that she will be Chozer L'Psachim, but that will be a cause of greater busha. So either way, the Shulchan Aruch paskens that for all purposes of staka, essentially, women come first. And the question is, so what about the Mishnah in Horius that says lahachios, that the man comes first? So we saw some approaches among the Rishonim who said that the Shulchan Aruch is wrong. They said it before the Shulchan Aruch said it. They said against the Shulchan Aruch that it's only clothing that has its priority, not food. And the Beis Yosef, who puts this priority into Shulchan Aruch, that for all stock woman comes first, makes a distinction between this and Hatzalah, which provokes some questions of its own. And then the question was also discussed by some of the Rishonim, like the Tosfos in the Iri, who suggests it goes back to the Chozer L'Psachim factor that the Mishnah was saying, that the assumption in the Mishnah, the assumption rather in our Gemara and Tzemach Zayin and the Braisa, is that it's possible to have other ways to get sustenance if you're not going to prioritize them. But the Mishnah in Horius is talking about absolute life-saving last-minute decisions where there are no other options, and how to decide how to save a life or not in accordance with that situation. Okay, we'll stop here, and we'll daven mincha. And so far, you should have an easier time staying warm and dry as the weather continues to at least temporarily.